Finally, I got the raft blown up, but the thing inflated itself upside down. Fortunately, there was a handrail around it of half-inch manila line. As soon as the raft expanded to its full size, we had grabbed hold of this. I was at the bow and struggled to twist the raft right side up, with the boys holding on so that we were fighting each other's weight as well as the clumsy vessel. After I struggled for 15 or 20 minutes, with the sea banging me in the face and filling my mouth with salt water, I did get the raft turned over once. I can't remember for sure whether I tried to climb onto it or not. The only thing I recall is that the raft flopped over, and I was mighty anxious to get on it. The handrail ran along the side, and the boys across from me had a grip on it. The raft weighed only 40 pounds, and their weight tipped it right over again on top of them. My work had been for nothing. By this time, we'd been floundering and coughing in the water for quite a while and were all exhausted, so then we calmed down and hung onto the handrail to rest. It was quite dark now, but our eyes were becoming accustomed to it, and we could see quite well, as anyone can after a few minutes in what at first seems to be pitch blackness. Jean spoke first.
"There's a way to get this thing over," he said, still a little short of breath.
Those deliberate words, spoken in a slow Missouri drawl with no more or less concern than if he were laboring over a recalcitrant mowing machine on his father's farm, brought our problem back to matter-of-factness. "We've got to stop and dope us out a scheme," I said. Tony chimed in. "All right," he said, blowing seawater from his lips. "How about we take off our blouses, tie them together, tie one end of the line to one side of the boat, throw that up across the bottom of the boat, then we all go to the other side and pull and see if we can't turn her over that way." The minute he said it, I knew that was the right answer, and I was chagrined that I hadn't thought of it myself. So we tied the blouses together, as Tony had suggested, worked around to the other side, and pulled, and boom, over she came, with a homely thwack on the water. "You stay here and hold her down while I get aboard on the other side," I said. In the raft, I pulled the boys aboard by the wrists one at a time, and for the moment our troubles were over. I looked around and reflected that it was swell to be alive, though why I should have thought that then, I don't know. As we huddled together in the darkness, trying to keep warm while the wind held our clammy clothes against us, we were not downhearted. I had confidence in the raft's ability to stay afloat, and the boys were sure we would be rescued in the morning. There was much complaining over the loss of our cigarettes and matches, which of course had been ruined in our long immersion. I too would have liked a cigarette, but most of all I wanted a cup of hot coffee. We settled down to rest as best we could until dawn, but we soon learned that we could not sleep. The raft was only 4 feet long by 8 feet wide. With its sides inflated like tires, it resembled an oblong donut. The dimensions inside were 80 inches by 40 inches. We discovered almost at once that it was impossible for three men to dispose this space so that any one of us would be comfortable. Tony lay most of the night in the bottom of the boat, his spirits seeming to rise and fall like the sea beneath us. Sometimes he would talk cheerfully, almost gaily, then he would lapse into a depressing silence, in which his gloomy thoughts could be felt by Jean and me, as we felt the darkness of the night. Jean perched on the gunwale, occasionally moving restlessly. He had been brought up in a rural community and chafed at confinement. He stood up to stretch occasionally, but found it hard to keep his balance with his feet pushing that thin rubber floor against the sea beneath us into a cushion. We passed a long night, it seemed. Our conversation, when we talked, consisted mostly of reassurance, repeated and repeated, that a plane or ship would find us in the morning. I hoped so and pretended confidence. Day approached imperceptibly until suddenly it was dawn, in the abrupt way of the tropics. All at once the sea appeared, a leaden gray. Then little white tongues of fire danced on the waves, and the east became a conflagration that resolved itself into a pleasant rising ball, the sun. Before this, as soon as the sky had taken misty form, we three were straining our eyes for sight of a rescue ship or plane. The boys discussed every possibility with cheerful eagerness. They were confident that many ships were scouring every square mile of this area to find us. If we weren't found today, they agreed, help would surely come tomorrow.
But I was not so sure. I was an old head in this business, and I knew that our admiral would not risk his entire force in a doubtful attempt to rescue three men. After all, we were at war. We were in the vicinity of known enemy positions and naval forces. There would be one quick look, and then we must be given up for lost. This would be a bitter pill for the boys to swallow, but it was only simple military logic. My thoughts were not gloomy, but they were hard, and I kept them to myself. A moment came when I thought the boys were right, and I was wrong, to my great relief. I judged it to be about 8 or 8:30 a.m. when we sighted the plane. At first I thought it was a bird, but far away as it was, we could see that it was steady on its course, and in a few minutes we heard the faint sound of motors. We jumped to our feet in our excitement and almost tipped over the raft. "Here, take it easy there," I ordered sternly. "We've still got plenty of time to drown." I didn't have to issue a second warning. We sat down carefully, keeping our eyes on the plane. She was from our own forces, all right. We looked at our watches, but they had all stopped at 7:40, evidently the moment our plane dropped from under us and we went into the water. I opened the face of my watch and lifted out the works. They were already corroded beyond repair. It was plain that we were being hunted. The plane approached on an easterly course at about 140 knots, never deviating from her line of flight. As she came nearer, we began to wave our arms, but there was no sign that we were seen. Then Jean and Tony began to shout. I wished we'd been able to save one of the parachutes. I would have opened it now and let it billow on the water. I made one quick search of the raft. There was not a single thing that we could use as a signaling device, except our shirts. Jean and Tony already had theirs off and were waving them wildly. Their voices were becoming hoarse from shouting. Evidently our tiny raft, being orange-yellow in color, was invisible in the silver path of the morning sun on the sea. The plane came closer and closer until she was within a half a mile of us. Finally, it was clear that we had not been seen. The plane was going away now, the sound of her motors dwindling to the southward like the last note of a dirge. I sank down upon the forward thwart. Jean and Tony were leaning by their hands on the sides, still waving half-heartedly, and staring as if their thoughts could bring him back. Now the plane was a speck in the sky, and the only sound was the lapping of the waves against the raft. Then the speck was gone, and we felt terribly alone in the immensity of sky and sea and sun. The boys sank down, their faces expressionless. I've been sorry that I said what I did then. It was automatic, I guess, and I didn't even remember until Tony recalled it later, bitterly. Boys, there goes our one and only chance.